Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeremiah Gorka, who writes about the politics and culture of security. From 2007 to 2010, he was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he conducted research for the U.S. military and was the lead author of the Mujahideen al-Haq in Iraq, a policy conundrum. He was also a member of a research team that helped to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a staffer on the Congressional Mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission, and an attorney with the United States Department of Justice. He has an op-ed at the American Prospect, Caught in a Bad Alliance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremiah Gorka.
Thanks so much, Ian. I'm glad to be back.
And clearly we have examples of their sort of terrorism as opposed to our sort of terrorism in the world today. By that I mean we've seen that a terrorist bomb killed three of Assad's top leaders, and there aren't too many people in the West that are losing tears over it, but terrorism is terrorism. And then now we have a bus being attacked in Bulgaria, killing a bunch of Israeli tourists. The Israeli Prime Minister and Defense Minister pinned that on Iran, with Hezbollah operating at the behest of Iran. And then you, of course, have studied a group of Iranian terrorists who are a lot of conservatives in this country want to, you know, be best friends with and take them off the terrorist list. So walk us through some of this gray area, if you will.
Well, terrorism is always a political definition. It's always hard to define. You have some people saying the sort of classic line that one person's terrorist is another's freedom fighter. But I think it's right to start with a general condemnation of violence in general, particularly against civilians. I mean, what we have in Syria, it looks like a terrorist tactic in a civil war, whereas what we have with the Mujahideen al-Haq is a group that was doing terrorist attacks for over decades against the Shah's government and then against the current Islamic regime. They stopped in 2001, or at least they said they did, and have been since then trying to get lots of attention in the United States and lots of allies among the leaders for the purpose of getting them off of the Foreign Terrorist Organization list. That's sort of their primary goal. It's a group that has been illegal in the United States since 1997. They've succeeded in getting off of the terrorist lists in Europe and the UK. The importance of this on one front is simply fundraising. It's illegal for them to raise funds. Once they get off of it, they can raise more funds for their goal. And the goal of the Mujahideen al-Haq is to become the new government of Iran. And so they are trying to get the U.S. They deny it, but they're basically working hard to push the U.S. into a war footing with Iran, and it seems that they have some degree of action in Israel. And as we can see, they're sort of a friend of my, enemy of my enemy is my friend. This seems to be going on both here and in Israel, vis-a-vis Iran. It's really kind of frustrating seeing how, for instance, in the response to the Burgas bombing, the first thing that the Israeli leadership says is that it was Iran's fault before we can really know exactly what happened. I mean, this seems to be the usual approach. When terrorism happens, we automatically blame it on someone and then sort of later on let the facts actually shake out. I mean, I still remember listening after the Oklahoma City bombing, and everyone immediately assumed it was an Arab terrorist and started throwing off all sorts of racist epithets on the radio, and then we find out that it was actually an American guy. So it's a time to pause, because what the MEK is trying to do and what so many other folks are trying to do is create this war footing, or at least massive sort of threat of war that it is good politics for some people. I mean, I find it interesting that on the same day that the Burgas bombing happened, the unity government crumbled in Israel. And so now Netanyahu's party has a very slim majority. It's standard political practice for political groups that are feeling threatened to play boogeyman politics and basically get rally their troops and their people behind a perceived threat. The MEK has been doing this constantly in the United States. They're the ones who first put the Iranian possible nuclear weapons program into the public eye, and they have been pushing that and pushing that and pushing that very effectively, not alone, but definitely in kind of a coincidence of interest with other folks who I think are interested in at least maintaining a threat of war with Iran. They've maintained this sort of steady narrative, so despite the fact that basically all officials in the U.S. and Israel and Iran all say that Iran does not have an ongoing nuclear weapons program, a huge majority of the American public that's been rated as high as 88% thinks that there is an ongoing weapons program. And, well, that's done a pretty good job of raising fears.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeremiah Gorka, who writes about the politics and culture of security. And we're talking about how one man's terrorist, I guess, is another man's freedom fighter, and the extent to which a terrorist group that has a lot of support in conservative circles here in the United States, particularly amongst the neoconservatives, and they, of course, are all the advisors for Mitt Romney. I noticed that when Mitt Romney was asked in December if he'd ever heard of the MEK, he said he'd never heard of them. I guess that might have a lot more to do with his apparent detachment from foreign policy, which I think he's going to pretty much outsource. But
so to speak, it certainly seems that way.
Right. But the article that you've written in the American Prospect, Jeremiah Gorka, Caught in a Bad Alliance, you point out that, and we noticed this just recently, that Newt Gingrich was seen bowing before this Iranian dissident terrorist group, their cult-like leader, Rajavi, and then the Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page got him in a lot of trouble because he took a $30,000 fee and was flown over to Paris to address the same conference that Newt Gingrich came to pay his respects to. But they're joining a long list, a bipartisan list of people who are working on behalf of the MEK to take them off the U.S. terrorist list. And that list includes former Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, former Homeland Security Advisor Francis Townsend, former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and former Vermont Governor Howard Dean. All of these have received, in some cases, $30,000 for speaking before this group. So this is kind of either tells you, one, that the MEK have a lot of money and know how to spend it, but maybe it tells you how easy it is to buy our politicians.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I my last piece that I wrote about them, about some of the folks who are taking money, and you know, for clarity, I should probably mention on one end, it's just that was the $30,000 price is just per speech, and a lot of people have given several. And Clarence Page is a rare one here to have returned the money after either after or before he got into some trouble for it. A friend of mine who I was speaking with, who is fairly well connected on the Republican side, took issue with me, and I realized that in part my argument was that the reason why people were taking this type of money, they couldn't be bought for this little $30,000 for people who are leaving, you know, government, who must be having huge salaries now. That a lot of these folks have their own security consultancies who would very likely benefit from the public trough if there's a war with Iran. And his response was, no, I don't think so. I think they probably could get bought off for $30,000. that is, it's sort of appalling. Sort of humorously, on the flip side, the MEK has alleged that the people who criticize it are taking far larger sums from the Iranian government. And I can say I certainly have not been offered any large sum of money to speak about this topic.
But my understanding is that, I don't know how closely the MEK works with Israel, but my understanding is that they've been providing the Israelis with a lot of the so-called intelligence about Iran's nuclear program. I'm not sure whether they've been directly connected to assassinations that have taken place of Iranian nuclear scientists, But if the accusations against Iran are correct about the bombing of the Israeli tourists in Bulgaria via, I mean, there's now some doubts about who did it. There was an initial claim by the Bulgarians that a Swedish terrorist who had spent time at Guantanamo was involved. That's been denied by the U.S., but the long and the short of it is that if it is blowback, give me a sense of how much the MEK is involved, to your knowledge, helping the Israelis and providing information to both the Israelis and the United States.
Well, if it's, I have a hard time imagining that the Iranian government would have ordered something like this at a time of such intense saber rattling. There's the next round of Iranian nuclear program talks coming up next week, Israel apparently canceling leaves for the defense force regarding what's going on in Syria. Iran backing away from Syria a little bit. It's so fraught that it seems to me that would have just been a very foolish thing to do, although that fits the narrative of people trying to make it seem like the Iranian regime is crazy, which I think is an argument to just make it them against them having a nuclear weapons program. It's very much like a Cold War trope about the crazy Soviets. But, you know, it would be possible that maybe Hezbollah, an Iranian-supported group, chose to do this as some blowback on its own. Possible. It's an interesting question whether the MEK was indeed involved in the assassinations of the Iranian nuclear scientists. I mean, there's arguments saying that's happened. Some folks have said it was Israel on its own in a new book. I don't personally know the answer on it. What I do find two things really interesting here, though. One is that a lot of the people who support the MEK among the neoconservatives, out of one side of their mouth, say it's because they're all democratic. On the other side of their mouth, it seems to support, like the fact that they have this history of violence and could easily return to it. The other, I think I forgot what my other point was. I would like to touch on something you said earlier, though, about Romney and his advisors. It's definitely true that a lot of his advisors are big fans of the MEK. You have John Bolton, you have Mitchell Rice, and former Attorney General Mukasey, and others. You know, for Romney, who has no foreign policy experience, his take, his sort of tactic here seems to be to act even more hawkish than Obama, who's clearly a pretty hawkish president, and so, you know, surround himself with the hawks in his part in the Republican Party to basically possibly to placate them. It could just be kind of a gang of rivals sort of approach, but it also could mean that he'd be very, you know, a president Romney might be very likely to want to listen to some of these former officials. And Bolton, for instance, who claims not to take money from the MEK, and his speeches, if you listen to them, to the MEK events, are very, very tailored, I think, to keep him safe in future confirmation hearings, that he doesn't say too much about the MEK, but he does lay it down very clearly that he is an absolute supporter of regime change fast.
Well, just in closing, Jeremiah Gorka, what's your sense of the what's going on in Syria in terms of terrorism being used against the regime? There's no question in the world that the Syrian Assad regime are some of the most brutal thugs that ever controlled a country, and they're using criminal groups, the so-called Shabia, to terrorize and murder and torture people across the country, and they seem to have absolutely no compunctions. And they may well resort to using their chemical weapons arsenal against their own people. But on the other hand, you know, terrorist bombs are being used against this regime, and I don't see any much condemnation coming from the West. And also, there's a lot of condemnation now of Russia and China for their veto today of the resolution to get tougher on the Assads. But of course, the U.S. has routinely vetoed condemnations of Israel hundreds of times. So give me, just in closing, give me a sense of this apparent inconsistency.
I think it, that when you look at Syria, it looks a lot like a modern version of the Great Game. It's U.S. versus Russia versus China, operating through proxies, using proxy forces, trying to reach for different types of resources. The hypocrisy is amazing when we read what our complaints about Russia having a military base in Syria and selling weapons to Syria and getting oil from Syria, as if that's not exactly what we would want to do and what we wanted to do in Libya. And we did. And one of the reasons why Russia is being somewhat recalcitrant, it seems, at least recalcitrant against our interests in Syria, is because this is so similar to, there's so many parallels with what happened in Libya. And I think that Russia feels burned by what happened to it, to its interests in Libya. And it lost billions of dollars of weapons contracts, for instance. I'm just waiting until a no-fly zone is created for Syria. I feel awful for Syrians. They're caught between that. They're caught between big powers who I think are kind of playing with them, and an awful, absolutely awful tyrant government that's been helped be propped up, and just terrible violence in the country. There's nothing good here.
Well, Jeremiah Gorker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeremiah Gorker, who writes about the politics and culture of security. From 2007 to 2010, he was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he conducted research on the U.S. for the U.S. military, and was the lead author of The Mujahideen al-Haq in Iraq, A Policy Conundrum. He was also a member of the research team that helped to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a staffer on the congressionally mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission, and an attorney with the United States Department of Justice. He has an op-ed at The American Prospect, Caught in a Bad Alliance. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the worst drought since 1956 that's caused the price of corn to go up 50% in the last 4 weeks. And then we'll also talk about the geopolitics of drought globally.